and welcome. Before I welcome Violetta, not all of you will know Jane, who's our new director of the library and archives here. So it's super to have you here, Jane. And this is the first of a couple of lectures this evening, so I hope some of you can stay on for the second one. The lure is that there's some food being offered after the lecture. Right through New Zealand church history, there's been various visiting evangelists and so on, and I guess Billy Graham is the most remarkable of them all. The only thing more remarkable is the wonderful title that I think it wins all prizes for a good title. Violetta has got first class honours last year in the history department. She got the James Clark Prize there, and she's just embarking on a PhD on, I think, gender and
emotion, marriage, various topics.
She's still honing the topic. So, Violetta, we're really very delighted to have you here, and we assure you that we know this is the first time you've spoken to such an ominous looking subject. So I've told everyone to be on their best behavior. So we welcome you very much.
Wow, thank you for that very kind introduction. I'd like to begin by thanking the Presbyterian Research Network for their very kind invitation to share my research tonight. As well as all of you, members of the audience, for taking the time to come down and listen. Well, Billy Graham needs very little introduction, perhaps save for members of my generation who've grown up in his quieter years. In 1949, the young, North Carolina preacher burst into the headlines after an astonishingly successful revival hosted in Los Angeles. And in many ways, this set of meetings anticipated the hundreds of urban revivals that he would lead across the world in the decades to come. Graham preceded his crusades with lavish publicity, church and business sponsorship, and scrupulous organization. Venues were typically enormous tents or urban sports grounds, and within them he would pack choirs of up to 5,000, which provided light-hearted jingles or more potent emotional renditions as required. And he concluded his gatherings with a powerful and direct method of appeal, the altar call, inviting the audience to rise and walk forward to show that they would attempt to become or be better Christians. And according to Graham's theology, this wasn't an easy commitment. It demanded a life of moral rigor, ethical integrity, and a readiness to spread the gospel of salvation. And the result was everlasting joy in heaven for the saved and everlasting separation for the lost. Now, those who indicated they were prepared to work towards the former, Graham called inquirers, for although they made decisions or decisions for Christ by rising at his call, Graham maintained that no one but God knew the heart well enough to call anyone a convert. Now, the Crusades, as they came to be known, steadily grew in size and frequency. Between the 1940s and the 1990s, Graham and his lively brand of evangelism travelled abroad as never before to Europe, Africa, Asia, Australia, and of course New Zealand. With the added outreach of electronic media, radio, television, print, and even the silver screen, all these things rendered Billy Graham the most seen, heard, and read evangelist in the history of Christianity. And by his retirement in 2005, he had preached to nearly 215 million people in 99 countries, and perhaps another 2 billion through live television. And taken together, those 6 decades of evangelism yielded more than 3 million recorded commitments for Christ. So around 500,000 New Zealanders participated in the 1959 Crusade meetings, from which Graham and his team harvested over 16,000 decisions for Christ in a spare 11 days. And the venues, Auckland, Wellington, and Christchurch there. So nationwide, a new interest in religious matters was widely reported. And Here I might add that all these headlines were taken from one newspaper, the Otago Daily Times, over a four-day period, from the 2nd to the 6th of April 1959, so he clearly caused quite a stir. And in its wake, the Presbyterian General Assembly passed a motion to give thanks to the Almighty God for the great blessing which attended the Crusade. And today I'll examine the New Zealand Crusade of 1959 with reference to popular culture and politics. However, I want to question to some degree the boundaries that are often charted between these dimensions of our history. Politics, like popular culture, is often considered to be solidly within the realm of the secular, whereas Billy Graham's crusade has been examined largely in terms of the religious, narrowly defined. I hope to demonstrate that focusing on the intersections and overlaps between religious and secular can enrich our understandings of both the 1959 crusade and the broader historical context in which it took place. And I also want to argue against a more general narrative of 1950s New Zealand. The most common image we encounter is of a dull, sheltered decade, pervaded by conformism, puritanism, intolerance. And for example, the Penguin History of New Zealand, Michael King lamented that stodginess permeated national life, while historian Miles Fairbairn agreed that creativity was recognised only in sport, war, growing grass, do-it-yourself hobbies and pastimes. And then a vast majority of New Zealanders continued to identify with one Christian denomination or another and filled their allotted pews every Sunday. And perhaps because of this, the 50s have received a somewhat unsympathetic treatment from historians. Moral panic is a somewhat condescending term frequently used to describe the outraged hand-wringing of Christian politicians, public figures, clergy and their flocks at reports of teenage sex scandals, violent crimes and antisocial behaviour that surfaced throughout the decade. An oft-cited cause was the flood of violent comic books, racy pulp novels, Hollywood films and rambunctious rock and roll music from North America. The pulp novel My Gun Is Quick and the film Rock Around the Clock was especially notorious. And as such, many historians have supposed that the brash, uninhibited behaviours of this new Americanised youth culture and the more sedate traditions of the religious and or socially conservative mainstream were somehow incompatible. The prevailing assumption has been that the respectable and repressed society of the 1950s could not possibly enjoy the pleasures of American popular culture. And the young people who were doing just that were presumably less religious or not religious at all. For example, this spread is taken from John Dix's Stranded in Paradise, New Zealand Rock and Roll, 1959-88. God's Own is an abbreviation for God's Own Country, as many of us may know, popularised by Thomas Bracken and Prime Minister John Seddon in the late 19th century. The devil's music is pretty self-explanatory. Now this, I will argue to this, that New Zealand's popular, political and religious cultures were a little more dynamic and interpenetrating than many scholars have credited. And as if to illustrate my point, here we see Billy Graham flanked by teen rock star Johnny Devlin and Prime Minister Walter Nash in the middle. So, by conventional logic, Walter Nash, principal representative of an ostensibly secular state, should not wish to be photographed or tacitly support the Christian, the 20th century's most iconic Protestant Christian leader by appearing in a photograph with him. And Billy Graham, for his part, stands shoulder to shoulder with a young man otherwise known as the Satin Satan for his titillating style of rock and roll music. And Nash should also presumably see a bit of a foe in Devlin, greasy-haired juvenile delinquency incarnate, which the establishment had battled to control throughout the decade. That Devlin should hold his conservative elders at arm's length goes virtually without saying. Was this so? One might fairly think so by looking at Johnny Devlin. He was New Zealand's first homegrown rock idol. Complete with ducktail, loud suits and hepcat lingo, he assimilated himself into the culture portrayed in American teen movies of the era, earning himself the title of the Wanganui Elvis. Devlin's first and phenomenally successful national tour of 1958 echoed the Presley brand of theatrical eroticism on a number of occasions. A stage-managed riot in Lower Hutt involving teenage fans from a boarding house whipped up a media frenzy after the Wellington opening night. In Invercargill, female fans mobbed Devlin's dressing room and attempted to remove his trousers, forcing him to escape from a toilet window. In Greymouth, fire hoses were turned on a mob that broke down theatre doors, while in Dunedin, a policeman lost a finger. And manager Graham Dent routinely unpicked Devlin's shirt seams for the pleasure of ecstatic female fans who could strip the former bodybuilder piecemeal and even look forward to receiving a piece of the King's shirt in the mail after the show was over. However, on April the 4th, 1959, the Satin Satan donned a suit and tie for Billy Graham's open-air ministry in Wellington's Athletic Park. And historian Bronwyn Daly later commented that the lyrics-wearing, guitar-toting rocker seemed to have transformed into a teenage choir boy. Outward respectability aside, an image peopled by a salacious milk bar cowboy and a man otherwise known as the 13th Apostle raises many questions, especially when it was brought about by this very polite telegram from to the Mayor of Wellington. And I quote, "Would you please convey to Dr. Graham and his party my sincere wishes on behalf of New Zealand teenagers for his continued success in promoting harmony throughout the Christian world. It is my greatest wish that I meet with with Dr. Graham while he was here in New Zealand. Sincerely yours, Johnny Devlin." So if Johnny Devlin was a fiery preacher extolling the virtues of rock and roll, these were not necessarily the virtues of the devil. Early in 1959, the press released an article entitled "Rock and Roll Singer, a Nice Young Man," claiming that Devlin had, and I quote, "none of the affectations cynics might expect of him," and throughout the piece emphasised his humble, soft-spoken manner and noted that as his portrait was being taken for the article, Devlin politely requested that another be taken with his parents, who happened to be present for the interview. And indeed, as one delves a little further into the Satin Satan's personal history and public image, the fault lines between religion and entertainment, church and stage, begin to blur. When questioned about his plans for his substantial salary, at the time the highest ever earned by a New Zealand musician, the former bank teller told the press that it was being banked and would later be invested. In an age where analogies between teenage consumerism and sexual intemperance were quite common, saving as opposed to spending was widely regarded as an admirable trait. Devlin was not, however, averse to spending on his family. He used his earnings to redecorate the family home and publicly aspired to retire his mother from her job at the Whanganui Hospital laundry. He married young and fathered his first child in early 1962, seeing the Woman's Weekly office flooded with letters of congratulations, many suggesting baby names like Elvis and Marlon. And a reporter from the Weekly observed that while the well-wishers included teenagers, they also included mothers, fathers, and even grandmothers. And Devlin was also noted for a sense of social responsibility. He performed charity shows for hospitals and for the intellectually disabled. And later in life, he would also brush off the suggestion of an autobiography, claiming that there would be little of interest as his experience of sex, drugs, and rock and roll was strictly limited to the latter. So while his outlandish style and onstage antics may have been a bit of a shock to the status quo, Devlin indeed seems to have been a nice young man. And although he did wear his faith on his sleeve, our Antipodean Elvis was in fact a practicing Catholic who attended church on Sunday even when on tour. Episcopal instruction discouraged Catholics from participating in the Billy Graham Crusades, but a priest approved his meeting with Graham, provided he didn't pray at the crusade. So if we look to histories of popular music and culture in New Zealand, we find Johnny Devlin cast as the figurehead of a fearless, enlightened youth movement, which railed against the puritanical attitudes of their elders, embraced modernity and sexual freedom. The fact that Devlin held his faith, family, and respectability in high esteem has, with few exceptions, been lost in the telling. At an institutional level, the story is much the same. Church and community groups didn't universally prohibit their young congregants from enjoying the latest teen fads from America. In fact, many were heavily invested in providing young people with safe and wholesome settings in which to enjoy them. In Auckland, churches financed and managed as many as 16 youth clubs throughout the 50s with a combined membership of over 5,000. The Otahuhu Teenage Club, with its rock and roll colours, Ming Blue and Black, claimed a total membership of over 600 in 1959, and its rules were pinned to the wall. No liquor, no smoking under the age of 16, and respect for female members. And here, youngsters could sip soft drinks and jive the night away under ample supervision. The bands that played regular stints were always sure to wind down a little early, preventing young revellers from becoming over-enthused in each other's company. Popular culture and religion could also mix in settings outside church walls. For example, at Invercargill's Civic Theatre, when in 1959, Australian rocker Johnny O'Keefe inserted a hymn halfway through his set. According to reports, the teenage audience fell respectfully silent and applauded, after which the hot rock and roll beat was picked up and the stamping, clapping and cheering resumed. So evidently, young people didn't uniformly display a haughty disdain for the Christian beliefs and customs of their elders. Christianity and entertainment would also come together in the 1959 tour of a prominent fellow believer. The toe-tapping hymnody, moving testimonies and electrifying sermons Graham offered made for a fine night out or bohemed by the radio for all ages. However, Australian historian Judith Smart argues that this appeal struck a deeper chord. She writes that his popularity was part of larger developments in popular culture and mass entertainment, to which the individual star, largely an American creation, was central. So how did Billy Graham appeal to the new cult of celebrity in New Zealand? Well, his Hollywood face stood him in very good stead and was consistently remarked upon by the New Zealand press. Before his arrival in the capital, freelancer Dorothy Moses enthused in the Evening Post, "Graham has a smile as million-dollarish as a movie star's," while another commentator described him as tall, slim, bronzed, with sharp blue eyes, a dashing smile, and an easy friendliness. And like his Hollywood counterparts, Graham appeared on silver screens throughout New Zealand in impressive full-length films such as Souls in Conflict and Wiretapper. And in 1956, three screenings of Souls in Conflict at His Majesty's Theatre in Dunedin were attended by over 3,600 people, including many from out of town. And moviegoers could be seen queuing down the street half an hour before the screenings were due to begin, and many were turned away. So in the months before the Crusade, Graham's face also jostled with those of Marilyn Monroe, Tony Curtis and Dean Martin in the dailies, the cinema billboards and shop windows throughout the major centres. And yes, hard-living men like Marlon Brando and James Dean did appear in the cinema of the 1950s, but they shared the screen with disciplined men like Charlton Heston and Jimmy Stewart, who were strong enough not to fall into the vices of sex and violence in the first place. And Graham sided strongly with the latter. His rugged good looks, trim physique, spiffy wardrobe and forceful gestures harnessed all the power of a man, harnessed all the cultural power of a manly presence. The press also dwelt on Graham's former ambition in professional baseball and described his rigorous exercise regime and the physical demands of his current occupation. The Evening Post even likened him to a spiritual boxer, with Satan as his opponent. And the New Zealand Crusade meetings, I might point out, were also held in sports parks. And ironically, the largest sporting crowds in New Zealand's history, which had only 3 years earlier gathered for the All Blacks versus Springboks tour in Carlisle Park, were rivaled by Crusade attendees. Altogether, they numbered more than 500,000, about a quarter of New Zealand's total population. And apologies for the grainy photograph, but there is quite a rivalry going on between those two crowds. So here we observe the impulses of popular religion at work. Rather than living in a cloistered vacuum, a significant number of Christian New Zealanders and their institutions engaged freely and enthusiastically with popular culture's latest, so much so that one of them became the country's first rock and roll superstar. We may also observe that Billy Graham fashioned a creative amalgam of Christian piety and celebrity entertainment, which appealed immensely to New Zealand audiences. And from this perspective, the boundaries between Christianity and popular culture, the transcendent and the worldly, appear quite permeable indeed. Now, the presence of a third party in our Crusade snapshot, Prime Minister Walter Nash, also begs to be addressed. And indeed, the state's public expression of support went above and beyond Nash's presence at Athletic Park. Governor General Lord Cobham received Billy Graham the day after his arrival in New Zealand at Government House, and they were snapped on the lawns, exchanging banter about each other's appearances. Present at Athletic Park with Walter Nash was Minister of Finance, Arnold H. Nordmeyer, Minister of Police, P.G. Connolly, and Deputy Leader of the Opposition, J.R. Marshall. Standing before the choir of 1800, Nash publicly welcomed the Billy Graham team to the dais at Athletic Park. Furthermore, no less than three government departments cooperated directly with the Crusade. The Post and Telegraph Department assisted with advertising, setting up landline relays and radio broadcasts, essentially spreading word of the Crusades and their music and sermons in real time to every corner of the country. The Railways Department ran special discounted gospel trains to the Crusades, while the Transport Department chartered buses, and both adjusted their schedules to manage the large numbers converging on the major centres. So how can we explain government support of the Billy Graham Crusades if our country's foundations are so highly secular? If we look to the history books, well, it would appear evident that many historians consider the secularity of the state to be self-evident. The fact that New Zealand's parliament, from the outset, refused to institute a state church, embraced free thinking and Jewish representatives, and secularised marriage law in 1854, public education in 1877, seems to confirm the state's foundational estrangement from all matters religious. In reality, from the beginning of settlement, a state which offered the churches no formal constitutional role in the running of the country was, in fact, open to fostering a myriad of endearing and formal links with them. Legal scholars Rex Adhaar and Ivanika Vidanovic go so far as to call New Zealand a de facto Christian state. New Zealand's parliamentary proceedings, national anthem, flag, coat of arms, public holidays, civic ceremonies, and laws enshrine Christian moral codes, practices, and symbols. And undeniably, the church also shaped and informed the values of many of New Zealand's political leaders. And Walter Nash, an Anglican lay preacher, Arnold H. Nordmeyer, a former Presbyterian minister, and J.R. Marshall, a practicing Presbyterian, were no exception. Here we have Arnold H. Nordmeyer very charitably painting a Presbyterian manse in 1977. And furthermore, the New Zealand government and its representatives espoused many similar approaches to the social issues of the day as those offered by the churches in Billy Graham's crusade. A return to the foundational principles of Christianity and the values and social forms of organisation it engendered in the family, the community, and the individual. The most productive example of these shared aims emerges with respect to the spiritual and social well-being of young New Zealanders. Young people who lived in the cities enjoyed leisure time. They had access to employment and discretionary income. And they could afford to go to the movies, to the dances, and buy cars and motorbikes. Agents of the new youth culture, similar to American greasers or British rockers, were New Zealand's bodgies, their female counterparts widgies, and their motorcycle-owning counterparts, milk bar cowboys and pylon pets. They dressed strangely, frequented milk bars, cinemas and record stores, thereby facilitating an invasion of loud American music, troubling films and racy literature. This image here is intended to illustrate just that. This is taken from Edward Arthur Manning's The Bodgy, A Study in Abnormal Psychology. the Auckland psychologist actually interviewed bodgies from New Zealand and Australia. His major argument, well, one of them, rested on the fact that popular culture, and more specifically youth culture, was so saturated by images of sex and violence that it was literally warping the psychologies of these young minds and normalising morally unacceptable behaviours. And these influences appeared to have very clear effects. In 1953, 59 Hutt Valley adolescents, 59, were charged with 107 sex offences carried out in darkened cinemas and unsupervised house parties. The following year, two Christchurch schoolgirls, thought to be lovers, killed one of their mothers when she tried to part them. And in March of 1955, Hawera teenager Sharon Skiffington was dealt a fatal shotgun blast by her spurned lover, Frederick Foster. Barely 3 months later, 19-year-old Albert Black plunged a 5-inch dagger into the neck of his rival, Alan Jacks, as he leaned over a jukebox in an all-night cafe in Auckland. A storm of interest in juvenile delinquency persisted throughout the decade. The press reported hordes of milk bar cowboys, bodgies and widgies running riot, and advised parents on how to check for the signs of the odd clothing cults in their own children. Historical accounts converge on the government's nationwide distribution of the Mars and Garb report in 1954, and in its wake, the tightening of censorship legislation, the enforcement of stricter standards in radio and advertising, and the unusually liberal dispensation of the death sentence to young offenders. As such, it's largely readings of state repression and outraged hand-wringing that dominate scholarly renderings of the 1950s. And where was religion in all of this? While many psychological reports, radio documentaries, and pages of print published on the troubles affecting youth, and for that matter, the disintegration of families, the rising tide of communism, the looming threat of nuclear war, conceived these social malaises in terms of spiritual poverty. And here we find a strong motivation for state support of the churches, Christian initiatives and events. They were perceived to be for the public good. They promoted the acceptance of common values and beliefs and really helped to hold the nation together. And it was a recognition of the social utility, as well as the personal sentiments of many politicians and their conviction that these were shared by their constituents, that underpinned the state's unembarrassed support of the prominent fellow believer who toured in 1959. And the example of government cooperation with the Billy Graham Crusade suggests that the state used Christianity not only to repress immoral influences, but to uplift and unite its citizens under the banner of a widely shared faith. In the face of threats of nuclear war and social upheaval, New Zealand's leaders supported a message that many found hearteningly familiar and immensely comforting. And throughout the crusade meetings, might I mention, the number of inquirers aged between 15 and 21 years old struck a steady 55% of those who walked forward or telephoned at Graham's invitation. Politicians were also not averse to building bridges with their teenage constituents directly. Here, for example, is Labor Cabinet Minister Mabel Howard jiving with Johnny Devlin at a rock and roll jamboree after one of his concerts. And as you can see, he only lost part of his shirt this time. Now, Billy Graham also had a history of unambiguously engaging adolescent culture. Here he is preaching in 1944 for the Youth for Christ movement. Their services offered, and I quote, all the gimmicks that reason would allow, famous athletes, stunts, music, sparkling singspiration, and timely testimonials. And the suit he wears in this image, we are told, was actually bright salmon pink. So in conclusion, to understand Billy Graham's 1959 crusade in religious terms, narrowly conceived, puts us in danger of seeing it as a mere exercise in expanding church roles. However, an image of Billy Graham rubbing shoulders with a national leader and a rock and roll superstar suggests that there were greater cultural forces at work. And likewise, examining the 50s without taking religion seriously has led many historians to conceive of it as a cultural battleground. The young worshippers of Hollywood and rock and roll revolted. A repressive state sought to drag them back to the status quo by any means necessary. All the while, a declining Christian conservative mainstream looked on in distress. And if we reintegrate religion into the social, cultural, intellectual, and political dimensions of our history, we arrive at a more nuanced understanding. Existing alongside antagonism, estrangement, and anxiety were many instances of cooperation, innovation, and enthusiasm. And like these images here, the example of Billy Graham's crusade to New Zealand in 1955 encourages us to see that the realms of religion, popular culture, and politics have long been on friendlier terms than our established national histories suggest. Thank you.